Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. There are millions of Americans, adults and children, who suffer from food allergies. Now, the symptoms can, in some cases, be mild, if annoying. However, it's possible that this can be a very serious matter, and in fact, rare cases, these kinds of attacks related to food allergies can be fatal. And this can also be very frustrating for parents of young children who perhaps suspect there might be some kind of food allergy problem with their child, but they're really not quite sure if that, in fact, is the case, how to determine what the problem is, and then what to do about it. This morning, in this first hour of the show, we will be talking about food allergies and try to ask some of the basic questions and also then give people who are listening the opportunity to ask questions. And our guest for the program is Dr. Wesley Birx. He is professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at the Duke University Medical Center. And among his interests are asthma, food allergy, and other childhood allergic diseases. This is Food Allergy Awareness Week, so we thought this would be a good opportunity to do it. And I'm sure that if there are people who are listening and have questions, that Dr. Birx will do his very best to help you out. One thing I also do want to mention for the benefit of who are in and around Champaign-Urbana, certainly there are a lot of resources available on the web if you have internet access that have to do with food allergies. But one I just want to mention because they are based here in the Champaign-Urbana area is the Central Illinois Food Allergy Network. And they have a website, and it should be easy to find if you're looking for information. And that is www.cifan.org. Or I'm sure if you put Central Illinois Food Allergy Network into your browser, you will find them. And of course, here, questions are welcome. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Dr. Birx, hello.
Thank you. It's nice to be here with you today.
Well, we really appreciate you giving us some of your time. Can you give us a number? How many people in the United States have food allergies?
For children that are less than school age, so less than 5 or 6, it's about 6 to 8% of children. And for adults, it's somewhere around 3 to 4% of adults in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that suggests, apparently, is that even though this can be a problem for children, that in some cases, children do grow out of this, and they may have some food allergy problems when they are at that age. That does not necessarily mean that they will take that allergy with them throughout the rest of their lives.
Yes, that's correct. The most common food allergies early in life are milk, egg, and peanut. Mm. And milk and egg most of the time are outgrown by school age. But peanut is an allergy that once you acquire it, most of the time it's lifelong. So there's a big difference between those three foods.
Mm-hmm. And that is one of those ones that some people can have quite severe reactions.
Yes, peanuts. To all three of them, you can have very mild symptoms or you can have life-threatening symptoms.
This seems to be something, that is, food allergy seems to be something that is getting more attention and more parents, I think, have questions about it, perhaps have issues with their kids with food allergies. Is it the case that we are simply more aware, or is there reason to think that the incidence of food allergies is increasing?
I think the first thing that there is scientific evidence that the incidence actually is increasing. There's some nice studies from Western Europe and the U.S. that show that. But also, as you suggested first, the public awareness, their perception of the prevalence also is increased. So it's some of both, but primarily the form of the incidence really has changed significantly in the last 20 years.
Hmm. That's it seems curious to me, just approaching it as a layperson, as I think about it, you think about the fact that human beings have been eating these things, milk, eggs, wheat, nuts, for a long time. Why is it that these things that have been in at least depending on where you live, a common part of the human diet should increasingly be causing problems?
Right. If in one instance, all of the allergic diseases, asthma, allergic rhinitis, other things like that have increased also in that time frame, but food allergy seems to have increased disproportionately more so than those others. So that's part of the equation. The other part of it is that how we eat a food as a society, how it's processed before we eat it, does play some part in the likelihood that you're going to develop allergies or not develop allergies.
I suppose the thing to point out here, I think that this is correct, is that in at least in some cases with allergies, before the symptoms develop, the individual has to be presented with the offender some number of times until you cross the threshold where you start to have symptoms. And perhaps here some people would say that indeed because of the way we eat now and that we eat a lot of processed foods and that there are food additives, things that are in food that may contain these allergens, or nowadays because of the nut allergy, there are some processed foods where on the label they say this has been processed in a plant where there are nuts in the vicinity, just so people make sure that they know that. It is the fact that now foods are complex and there are all kinds of things added to them. Does that, do you think, contribute to the problem?
I think the scientific understanding, we have a long way to go to try to know why that is. I'm not sure as much it's what we add to the foods. It's more how it's processed, whether it's heated or not heated, or whether it's heated in solution or not heated in solution. In the animal experiments, those two factors play a bigger part than maybe some of the other additives that you actually put in foods when it's processed that would change the likelihood that you're going to develop a reaction. Hmm. What you said earlier, I think, is important, though. And medically, we would call the first exposure or the first several exposures sensitization. So you have to, your immune system has to have seen the food before, and then you develop an allergic reaction, and it may be the second time or the fifth time or even the tenth time that you eat it, then you develop symptoms. So you have to have seen it, you become sensitized, and then at a subsequent time you have the allergic reaction.
I think one of the things that we know is that the foods that cause the problem, it's a relatively small number of foods that cause the problems, and you've mentioned some of them. What are the foods that are most likely to cause an allergic reaction?
In the United States, there are 8 major foods that cause most all of the reactions, and it's not all of them, but it's most of them. So egg, milk, and peanut are about 80% of those, and then you add in wheat, soybeans, fish as a group, so the multiple types of freshwater fish, shellfish, and then the tree nuts. And the tree nuts are pecans or walnuts or Brazil nuts. And again, those would be put together as a group. So those 8 foods or food groups constitute most of the allergic reactions in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And are there other things that, for example, I know that there was one article that I looked at here, quoting you, saying that you think that we may be starting to see an increasing problem with people who have an allergic reaction to sesame seeds or sesame products. Are there other things that maybe are not as big a problem as these, the major ones, but where we think that they're is a potential problem, and that depending on what kind of exposure people have, that there is a possibility that those things could also develop into a serious problem?
Yeah, so it's not uncommon for foods like chicken or beef or pork or whatever meat is in the child's diet. Those aren't among the most common, but again, they're not rare for those to happen. Sesame is a seed, and it's a little bit different than the other tree nuts that we talked about, but it's been increasingly used in the United States. We've seen a huge change in the prevalence of sesame seed allergy in Western Europe in the last 10 years, and we're starting to see that now in the U.S., that it's not as common as the other 8 foods that we talked about, but it would be in the top 10 or 12 of the foods that we would see children having allergic reactions to.
Mm-hmm. What happens inside the body when one has an allergic reaction? Why does that happen?
2 things have to happen. One is that you have to have the right genetics or the right genes, and we know a little bit about what that is for all of the allergic diseases. And then environmentally, you have to be exposed at the right time. That's the same thing true for food allergy, for asthma, if it has allergic causes, for allergic rhinitis. So you have the right genes and at the right time, the environmental exposure. And the thing we don't really understand well for a food allergy is what that right environmental exposure is. Is it in utero? Is it in the first few months of life? Or is it later, say after age 3, that really is a critical time that you either need to be exposed or you don't need to be exposed to the food so that you are less likely to develop the allergic response?
You mentioned something, I think we just want to underscore it, is that there is a genetic component here, so that if you, particularly for parents who have questions about the likelihood that their children might develop food allergies, if mom or dad have them, if other people in the families have them, then that would increase one's risk or the likelihood that the kids would also have them?
What the family history does is only for the immediate family, so it'd be mother or father and one of the siblings, a brother or a sister. It doesn't really matter about the aunts or uncles or grandparents or cousins. So if you have nobody in the family that has, in the immediate family that has any allergic disease, the chance of a new child having allergic disease is about 20%. And that could be asthma. It could be eczema, which is an allergic skin rash that happens early in life. It could be allergic rhinitis or food allergy. If one parent or one sibling has it, it increases to about 40%. Or if two people have it, so say both parents or one parent and another sibling, it increases to about 60%. And again, it's not that the parent has asthma and the child has asthma. It's the parent may have asthma and the child may have food allergy or vice versa. So it's just the allergic tendency that's inherited. And then that environmental exposure, when it and how it occurs, likely influences whether you have allergic rhinitis, whether you have asthma, whether you have food allergy.
So knowing, for example, that a child has food allergy, would you then be a little bit more concerned that it's possible that also that child might develop asthma, or does it not work like that?
No, it actually does. That's a good question. Yeah. For the children that have eczema, which is an allergic skin rash, and food allergy, about 3/4 of them at some point in their life go on to develop allergic rhinitis or allergic runny nose, and about 1/2 of them go on to develop asthma. So a child who's a year of age that has eczema, which is that allergic skin rash, and they're allergic to eggs, then that child has a really good chance that they're going to develop allergic runny nose at some point, probably in childhood, and a really good chance also that they'll develop at least some symptoms of asthma.
Let me, for people who might just have tuned in, introduce again our guest. We're talking with Dr. Wesley Burks. He is professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at the Duke University Medical Center. And in his work, is particularly interested in asthma and food allergy and other childhood allergic diseases. And we're talking this morning about food allergies, a little bit about what they are, what the common triggers are, how they are detected and treated. We'll ask some of the basic questions here, but of course people who are listening are also welcome to call with questions. In Champaign-Urbana, here where we are, 333-9455. That's the number to call. We do have a toll-free number as well, so that means if you were listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, and it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. And also people who are listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may also use the toll-free line. Again, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There are people who do have problems eating certain foods. They have tolerance problems. So it is possible for one to have to be intolerant to certain kind of foods, to have some of the symptoms of allergies, but for this not to be a true food allergy. What exactly is the difference between food allergy and food intolerance?
When you use the term allergy, it means that your body's immune system is reacting abnormally to the food that you're eating, and it's a fairly reproducible reaction. So if today I eat milk or an egg and I have symptoms, then tomorrow if I do the same thing, I'll probably have the same symptoms. That immune system can change over a long period of months to years, but within a few weeks to months, it stays pretty much the same. So that's your immune system. And intolerance may be something like you're deficient in your gastrointestinal tract and one of the enzymes that helps digest some of the milk that you drink. So you would be intolerant of lactose. So if you drink milk or maybe a glass of milk, then you'll begin to have gastrointestinal symptoms like cramping or bloating or maybe gas. And that's not caused by the immune system. It's caused by a lack of that enzyme that won't digest the lactose in your gastrointestinal tract. So that's the primary difference in them. So for lactose intolerance, you can have maybe a teaspoon of milk and not have symptoms. But if you drink a glass of milk, you'll have significant GI symptoms. Hmm. On the other hand, if you have allergy, a teaspoon and a glass, you're going to have allergic symptoms both times. They may be a little bit less with a teaspoon, or they may not. You can't really tell. But still, you're going to have symptoms both times.
We have one caller here. Certainly other people who are listening are welcome to call. Let's take this first on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Sarah, and I'm calling from Champaign. And I'd like to ask the doctor a question. My son developed a milk allergy at 5 months. And I wanted to know, I'd like to have more children, and do I need to stay away from dairy and milk while I'm in my next pregnancy with hopes that my next child would not have the allergy?
So the answer to the question really depends on the type of milk allergy that your child had at 5 months.
Okay, he still has it. He's now 15 months, and he's allergic to all milk proteins.
So does he have skin symptoms and GI symptoms? Does he have skin and GI symptoms or just GI symptoms when he takes the milk protein?
Currently he gets hives if he's even if I have eaten something with dairy and kissed him, he'll get a hive.
Okay, that helps.
Type of thing. And his first reaction was he had hives and turned bright red. He's never really had intestinal problems that I'm aware of because we caught it pretty quickly.
Okay. So for the next child, that him having milk allergy isn't really as important as him just having an allergic disease. So for the next child, their chances of having an allergy are going to be increased because of that. I think the question that you asked, though, is a really good one, and unfortunately we don't have a right answer right now. What's been suggested in the past by the American Academy of Pediatrics is that if you are in an allergic family, that you avoid milk for the first year of life for the child, egg for 2 years, and then peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish for 3 years. And so that's been what the pediatricians have practiced for the last 10 to 15 years. Those guidelines probably will be changing within the next year because we don't know that that's the right thing to do.
Okay,
so if I was seeing you in the clinic, I would suggest maybe that you avoid the peanuts, tree nuts, fish, and shellfish, but not really necessarily avoid milk or egg because we don't know that that's going to be helpful.
So the
other part of that question would be what you would do while you're pregnant. And
Correct. Again,
there's not a right answer.
Okay.
I think it's probably better not to avoid anything because then your diet becomes deficient in protein and other things. And it's really better to have a healthier, more nutritional diet than try to avoid things.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thanks for the call. That perhaps gets to the question of what, for people who suspect that they might have allergies or intolerance to certain things, particularly allergies, they might say, well, I think I have an allergy to food X, so I'm just not going to eat that. And if you have enough of those things, then that, as you suggest, one of the problems could be that that could lead you to have a not very well-balanced diet. And so the question is, how important do you think it is for someone to actually be assessed by a doctor who does that sort of thing? Either, I suppose it could be either a family practice physician or someone who specializes in dealing with allergies, and actually get a diagnosis so that they know for certain that they are allergic to certain things.
Right. I really think it depends on the patient and their age. So if it's a young child versus an adult, it also depends on the food that you're talking about and what you're trying to avoid. And then the last part would be on the symptoms that they're having. So I'll give you a couple of examples. There are some adults that have symptoms after they eat something like a cantaloupe or a watermelon, and they have itching in their mouth. They may have a rash on their lips, but they have no other symptoms. And it's called the oral allergy syndrome. And the reason they have that is because that patient originally had allergic rhinitis, and they make a protein called IgE to the ragweed. And when they eat the watermelon or the cantaloupe, that ragweed protein looks like some of the proteins in the watermelon, and so their immune system reacts to the watermelon. But it only occurs in the mouth, makes your mouth itch some, and it feels kind of funny. It also can happen with a banana. But interestingly, if you were to cook the banana in some way, it destroys or tears that protein up, and so you no longer have a reaction to it. It's really very mild symptoms. So if you're eating a piece of cantaloupe and your mouth itches, you probably recognize that and you wouldn't need to do anything else. But on the other hand, if it's a three-year-old and the mother suspects that they're allergic to peanuts, then they probably do need to see their primary care doctor and or a referral physician such as an allergist, because they need to understand where peanuts are hidden in the diet. They also need to understand that they need to have the epinephrine with them all the time and an antihistamine. They need to know how to do it. They need to know how to identify with the school or the daycare, where peanuts are in the environment so that they lessen the chances of having a reaction. So it really depends on the age, the food you're talking about, and the symptoms that they're having.
Let's talk with another caller. This is someone, line number two. Hello.
Hi. My name is Shelley, and I actually have two children with food allergies. But my question is in regards to allergy testing. I think as a parent of children with food allergies, we tend to hinge upon the scores from blood testing and or reactions from skin testing. Is there one that's more accurate or actually would predict reactions or future reactions? And I guess also, what is the thought on testing for things when a reaction hasn't occurred? I know my son had a positive RAS test to sesame seeds, but in fact he's never really had a reaction, and we're going to be going in for more skin testing soon. Do you test for sesame seeds since there hasn't been a reaction, or I'm not sure. There are so many, it seems like statistically when you read about it, there are so many false positives and inaccurate testing.
Yeah, so that's a really good question. The diagnosis of food allergy really is like a puzzle, and you put the different pieces together, and the testing that you do is a piece of the puzzle, but it's not the main piece. It's not the only piece. It's just part of the whole complex, the whole picture to try to make the appropriate diagnosis. So with that said, when you do the testing, there are two different types of testing, as you suggested. You can do a skin test, and that's done where you take a drop of the food in question from a manufacturer, and you can either place it on the forearm or the back, and then you touch it with something as simple as a sewing needle. So you prick it. It's called a prick skin test, and then you look for swelling or redness. And the other way that you would, another diagnostic test would be to draw blood from the child and then take the serum, which is a clear part of the blood, and then test that. So both of those tests look for IgE, which is an abbreviation for immunoglobulin E, to the food. So the really good thing about the diagnostic test is that if you look for them and they're not there, then the child or the patient is not allergic to the food. It's a really good negative predictor. So if you think your child might be allergic to peanuts and they did a peanut skin test or they did a peanut blood test and it's negative, there's not a high likelihood at all that they're allergic. It's a really high likelihood that they're not. So it's a good negative one. The problem is that the positive predictive value is only about 50%. So it's not that it's a false negative test. There really is IgE there, but not everybody that has IgE, if you give them the food, will have a reaction. And so hopefully that makes a little bit of sense. And that's why you may have IgE to various other foods, but you're eating those and you're not allergic to them, because you can have IgE to foods and sometimes have allergic reactions, and then IgE to other foods and not have reactions. And scientifically, why that is, what I just talked about, there's lots of research going on worldwide to try to understand that better. The other part of your question is, how much IgE you have will make the number go up on the blood study, but it'll also make the size of the swelling on a skin test be higher. Mm-hmm. Neither one of those will predict the severity of the reaction. So the higher the number on the blood study that you have makes it just likely that your child is allergic. It doesn't have anything to do with the severity of the reaction. So the typical blood study that's done in the U.S., there are a few different ones, but the major one that's being done, the values range from less than 0.35, which is a negative, to the highest one, which is greater than 100. So you can have all the numbers in between. So as an example for peanuts in that test that you're talking about, if a child has a blood test to peanuts, their IgE is above 14, there's about a 90%+ chance if you give them peanuts, they'll react. So if their blood level is 15, or if it's 50, or if it's greater than 100, it's still about a 90% chance they'll react. Each of those successively as they get higher don't mean that it's going to be a worse reaction, though.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. We have one more caller here we'll get on to in just a moment. We are at our midpoint, and I would like to again introduce the guest, Dr. Wesley Birx. He is professor and chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at Duke University Medical Center. He's interested in a number of things, including asthma, food allergy, other childhood allergic diseases. We're talking about food allergies, what they're all about, what causes them, how they can be detected, how they can be treated, and questions are certainly welcome. I do also want to mention again that there are a lot of resources that have to do with food allergies on the internet, and one for people who are here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, a relatively new group that was organized to try to bring parents together so people can share information, share their experiences, ask questions. That's the Central Illinois Food Allergy Network, and they're on the web if you have internet access. It's at www.cifan.org. So for Central Illinois Food Allergy Network, CIFAN.org. And, of course, here on the show, questions are welcome. That's why we're doing it. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, line number one. We'll get right to them next. Hello.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had a question about... related to some of the genetic engineering of crops and things like that. I remember reading a few years ago that some food crops might be getting peanut genes in them and mouse genes and all kinds of odd things that you wouldn't expect. And I wondered if that has actually happened, and if so, what effect is it having on people with allergies?
That's a good question. There are not any food products that we currently eat that have been engineered to try to make them less allergenic. There are other things that are being done to the foods to try to help either in crop production or make it a better, more nutritional food. There are research studies going on to try to lessen the chances of a patient reacting to, say, peanuts by changing the peanut in some way. But those studies are a long way off from trying to make a peanut truly hypo or less allergenic. I don't think with the current technology that we have, it's really going to be feasible. I really jokingly say, as we talk in some of the medical groups, that if you took all of the proteins out of a peanut so that it would no longer be allergic, you would have a soybean, and we already have a soybean, so there's really not a reason to try to do that. The thing that may be a little confusing is that as you read in the newspaper, some of the magazines, there are people trying to work on different types of therapy or immunotherapy for patients that have milk and egg and peanut allergy. And one of the major studies for peanuts is to try to take a protein and change it a little bit so that it could be used for immune therapy to make the child no longer allergic. It's not being changed for eating. It's being changed for the therapy part.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. That sounds like that essentially is what a vaccine does, right?
Yes, and that's what the studies that are going on now, and they have been for the last several years, and some of the animal experiments, and they're getting ready to start in humans within the next 9 to 12 months.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding this. I think that I have also read some suggestion that for people who have some food allergies, that it's possible for the body to build up its resistance in a sense by presenting the person with very small amounts. This is like systematic desensitization. That it is possible for some people, if you do that over a long enough period of time, that the body then will in a sense build up a resistance, and that then you won't have that allergic reaction anymore.
Yes, what you're referring to, there are some studies that have been going on for the last 2 or 3 years, and it's really all in experimental investigational studies now, that patients, primarily children that are allergic to peanuts, milk, or egg, are being desensitized, just as you suggested, and it's taking somewhere between 6 to 9 months to even get them up to the equivalent of one peanut. So it's a very slow process. Again, it's being done on an investigational basis. It's not something that should be done at home yet or even in primary care or even by an allergist because of the difficulties and the allergic reactions that are going on with it. But what it, those studies have shown us, though, is that there really is some promise for the treatment of food allergy, and I really think in the next 5 years we'll have at least the first generation of treatment.
All right. Let's go to another caller. This is line 3. Hello.
Hi. I'm calling with a question regarding children and pet allergies. We've got some children that have various allergies and are on Zyrtec and had slight dog allergies, and we put our dog down last year, but they keep bugging us to get another animal, and we were considering trying to get a hypoallergenic dog. What are your comments or thoughts on that?
A couple of thoughts. One is that not knowing what types of symptoms that your children had after they were exposed to a dog, what you develop in the allergic reaction to a dog is actually a protein in the saliva of the dog. And in a pretty real sense, there really aren't hypoallergenic dogs. There are dogs that maybe have less saliva, but there aren't dogs that there are significant differences in the amount of protein. Even among different species, the proteins are pretty similar, and if you react to one species, you're going to react to another one. So it really depends on the symptoms that your children were having initially, and whether it was asthma, whether it was allergic rhinitis. If a child is having allergic symptoms, say they wheeze when they go into a house that has a dog, and they take the dog out of the house, it takes up to 6 months just for the protein to leave the house after a lot of cleaning before you would expect them no longer to have symptoms when they go in the house. So the other part about the question is that if you do any tests like the skin test that we talked about earlier, they're really predictive for right now. So if you had your child tested today to find out if they're allergic to dog and it was a positive test, then they're probably, they would react if they were around a dog. If the test is negative, though, and then you put a dog in the environment, in a year they could be allergic because you've put, with the right genetic information, you know, the genes that we talked about earlier, you put into their environment a dog, and now they develop a new allergy.
I see. And if the risk of they're only moderately allergic to the dogs, to cats they're highly allergic, but the risk of having them around something that they're allergic to, other than possible sniffles, is that it might develop into asthma at some point? Or, I mean, what's the really bad downside other than being a little bit uncomfortable?
Yes, it's that there are some children that, as you just described, particularly around a cat more so, but also a dog in some instances, that the more they're around it, they'll develop symptoms of asthma, which can be life-threatening even on exposure to a cat. So you can't, if they just have some sniffles right now, then it may stay like that, but it could progress to more asthma-like symptoms later. And that's probably the biggest concern that many people would have about keeping a pet, as I said, particularly a cat in the environment, because the symptoms can, on exposure, to continue to progress over a period of months to years.
All right.
I think that, what we would talk with our families about is that, say for the question you had earlier about the dog initially, that knowing that there is some downside or risk to putting a dog in the environment for them having some sniffles or maybe some other symptoms, but also the positive things that you get out of having a pet in the home. So I think it's a decision by the family looking at the positive and the negative aspects and then trying to make a decision based on all the aspects of it, not just the allergic symptoms.
Yeah, I think we're overwhelmingly aware of the positive aspects, but I'm trying to conservatively look at the downsides and not do anything that screws up my kids. One other quick question, and then I'll let you go on another caller so I don't preoccupy you, but I remember reading about a University of Iowa study about dirty houses, the gist of the study was that it was suggesting that if you keep your house too clean, and protect yourself against all allergens, that you're actually going to increase your sensitivity to allergens.
Yes.
Are you familiar with that, or does that make any sense?
Yes.
Or?
No, it does make sense. There's a theory that's been purported for about the last 15 or 16 years, and it's called the hygiene hypothesis. And it came out of some research in Eastern Europe, and they looked at children that were born on farms, and actually they were born in houses that the cows were housed literally inside the home. So it's a different type of farm than we might see here in the U.S. And those children at age 5 and 10 had a lot less allergic disease. And they looked at what types of exposure they had. And they were exposed to lots of different things, including lots of bacteria in the environment that seemed to stimulate their immune system in a different way or preoccupy it, and they couldn't develop allergic disease. So there have been studies here in the U.S., and the University of Iowa did some of those studies, particularly in animal models, to look at how a really healthy, what we think of as a healthy, clean environment, may be not distracting our immune system like the more dirty environment that they would have seen in what I just described earlier. So that's kind of a prevailing hypothesis about why there is more allergic disease. Not all of the pieces scientifically fit together perfectly. It really wouldn't change necessarily the prevalence of allergic disease in the U.S. in the last 15 years because we're not necessarily living a cleaner now than we were, say, in 1985. But there are parts of it that do make sense, and they're interesting.
Thank you.
Just for a second here, and I have some other callers I want to get to. I think that there are parents who go through difficulties with their kids where the kids obviously are not happy. They're maybe having difficulties, and the parents are just have a hard time figuring out what's going on and eventually get round to thinking about allergies and figuring out that there are some allergies present, and by making changes in the diet, children seem to be healthier and happier. But it took them a little while to get to that point. Some of the symptoms that we're talking about, the allergy symptoms, can be, it seems to me, a little on the vague side, or at least if you're talking about cramps and diarrhea and skin rash and sinus congestion, well, there could be all sorts of reasons why one would have those symptoms. It might not necessarily be an allergy issue. How do you encourage parents to think about, just at least approach the question of, is it possible that my child actually does have a food allergy?
That's a good question. I think that what we really try to concentrate on as we talk with families is that there are three of the organ systems of the body that are primarily affected by food allergy. And the first one is the skin, and you have rashes or an itchy rash. So it's whelps or hives or whatever you want to call it. The second one is the GI system or the gastrointestinal system, and you primarily would have vomiting, severe cramping or abdominal pain and diarrhea, or a combination of those. And then the last one would be the respiratory system, and that would be your throat closing up, coughing, wheezing. So you have the skin, the GI, and the respiratory tract. And the thing about food allergy is it's pretty straightforward in the diagnosis, is that every time you eat the food, within literally seconds to minutes most of the time, you'll have those symptoms. So if you suspect that your child is allergic to milk, every time they come in contact with the milk protein, which may be with milk, it may be with cheese, it may be with ice cream, they're going to have either skin, GI, or respiratory symptoms within literally seconds to minutes. It can be an hour, but it's not the next day or it's not a week later. So that temporal association with pretty classic symptoms, that those are the primary ways that you might do the diagnosis.
We have about... Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the things that I think is difficult about particularly food allergy is that the public perception, if you look at any of the lay surveys, is about a third of families think that somebody in the family has food allergy. And we talked earlier about the scientific reality. For young children, it's about 6 to 8%, and for adults, it's 3 to close to 4%. So there's a huge chasm between the public perception and then the scientific reality of food allergy.
Well,
some of the vague symptoms that you talked about earlier are attributable, or people think that they're food allergy, and when people try to validate that or prove that by giving them the food, because they're very subjective symptoms, they really can't be validated a lot of the time.
So there may be a lot of people out there who think that they may have food allergies, or their children do, when they don't. In some cases, could that be intolerance, or could it be actually something else completely different?
Actually, both of them. Sometimes it's intolerance, like the lactase deficiency we talked about earlier with milk. Sometimes it may have been food poisoning the first time they had the a contaminated food with bacteria in it, and the next time they had the food, they didn't have symptoms, but they still felt like they were allergic. So there's lots of reasons that people feel like that they're allergic on one ingestion, and they don't continue to eat that because they became so sick after that one time.
Our guest in this hour is Dr. Wesley Burks. He's professor in chief of pediatric allergy and immunology at Duke University Medical Center, and we're talking about food allergy. Questions are welcome. We have several people who are ready to go, and we'll try to get as many as we can. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll free 800-222-9455. Our next caller is on our line number two. Line two, right here. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask you if you could elaborate on something you were saying before when you were mentioning about watermelon and cantaloupe and a kind of a mild reaction that can happen. For myself, like around 10 years ago as an adult, I started to, when I would eat any kind of like tropical food, mango, pineapple, some melons but not watermelon, I would get what you were describing, like a swelled tongue and itchy eyes and so on. And I thought that that was some kind of allergic reaction. It was a little bit startling because I don't generally have any kind of allergies. And you mentioned it earlier, and I was just going to ask. I just wanted to ask if you could elaborate on a little bit.
Yes, the symptoms that you're having are medically called the oral allergy syndrome, and it happens sometimes in kids, but more often in adults. And it's typically a food that you've eaten for several decades even, and sometimes in your 20s or 30s or 40s, you then begin to develop symptoms. And it's confined only to the mouth. You sometimes have a little swelling of your tongue. Your palate itches. It only lasts for a few minutes. And like as I said, if you actually cook the food, then you wouldn't have the same symptoms because it changes the protein.
Uh-huh.
Typically, people that have that also have hay fever type symptoms, or at least some of them, so that in the fall you might have a little bit of nasal congestion, sneezing, water, itchy eyes for maybe a month to 6 weeks when the ragweed's out.
Yeah, I don't. Uh-huh.
Okay. Which is typically you would have those symptoms in addition to the fruit-like symptoms, but sometimes they're much milder. And typically it's a pretty benign process in that your mouth itches a little bit and it goes away and it doesn't spread to cause life-threatening symptoms.
Do those particular foods have something in common?
They do. They have proteins that are similar to each other, and they're also similar to some of the airborne pollen, like the ragweed that we talked about earlier. The IgE that your body makes against one of them is going to be pretty similar to some of the others. So you talked about you could eat maybe a watermelon, but not a cantaloupe or another melon.
Yeah, exactly.
So another person, it may be all the melons. So there's some variability in that. But that's the reason it is, because those proteins are pretty similar in each other.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you. Let's go to line number one next, right here, line one. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to thank Dr. Burks for being with us. We have a active community of parents of kids with food allergies here in Central Illinois, and we're all very excited to hear you talk and grateful for the research that you're doing at Duke as well. I wanted to go back to the sensitization question and ask a question about, we have a lot of families in our food allergy network here who are, what started out as severe reactions when their children were little are now getting to the 4 and 5 year olds, and I'll use my son as an example. Right now he's 3 and a half, but we've been tracing his blood levels consistently since he was 8 months old. He was diagnosed with severe nut and peanut allergies as well as some other things. But in the last few months, his blood levels have come down to the point where his peanut is like 1.2, up, down from 5 or 6. And he's reacted skin-wise upon being kissed by somebody who's eaten peanuts or walnuts, so we know that it's a true allergy. My question is, if we do twofold, I guess, if we do a challenge test with him and it comes back positive and he reacts to the peanut, have we set him back any in doing that challenge? Is my first question, versus if we had just waited to do that and continued to watch his blood levels come down.
Okay.
And second of all, if he is one of these lucky 20% who would outgrow a peanut allergy, as all of us in our Sci fan group are hoping, is there a chance, we've heard some stories of kids who have been sensitized, which I know is different than outgrowing it, but about that allergy coming back severely later in life without warning?
Okay, so both of them are good questions. In the type of study that you're talking about, which is the blood study that you draw their blood and you look for the IgE and the number that you give, typically what we might do is somewhere around school age if a child has the IgE to peanut, but also to milk or egg, if it's in the 1 to 2 range, mm-hmm. then at that time there's about a 50% chance that they've outgrown the allergy. And so we would suggest a challenge test, as you suggested. And we would have them come to our office and do it really slowly over about an hour, starting out with a peanut butter about the size of a half a grain of rice, and do that incrementally to see if they would tolerate a tablespoon of peanut butter. And if they can tolerate a tablespoon, then they can tolerate peanut butter in their diet. So if you do the test and it's negative, meaning they tolerate the food, and you put it in their diet and they start eating it, then it's not going to come back.
Okay.
So if you do the test and it's positive, so they have a reaction on the challenge, then you didn't necessarily, by doing the challenge, you didn't cause it to come back. It was there anyway because there was a 50-50 chance. So a positive challenge means you just keep it out of their diet. A negative challenge, if you put it in their diet and they're eating it, fine. The people that, and it is pretty uncommon to rare for it to come back later, the way you can tell that is that once you pass the challenge and you start to give them peanuts or try to put peanut butter in their diet and they just have food refusal, then those are the children that it seemed to come back in. If they put it in their diet and they start eating it, then it's not going to come back.
The kids who don't like it and don't want to eat it.
Right. Those are the ones that I'm more concerned about and I would talk about with a family and not trying to force them to eat it. But if they pass the challenge and they start eating peanut butter sandwiches, then that's the child. It's going to stay away. It's not going to come back.
Okay. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you. Let's go to line 4 next. Hello. Line 4, toll-free line.
Yes.
Go ahead.
Yes. Thank you. I hope what I'm about to ask is germane. Life on Earth has a totality, and what we have now experienced with man-made chemicals on the food supply, the eradication of good, bad, or ugly, however it's construed by people that do those things. And I guess the most egregious, if it is germane to what is being discussed, is the spreading of animal and human waste on farm fields, and human waste and medication. This is, I guess, my primary concern. If that breaks down in the bowel or in the blood, or if it is what is not, is then put upon the ground. I know that sounds terrible, but I think it should be addressed, and what happens to that, and how, you know, it's always the very old and the very young who are affected. Would you have a comment?
It's interesting, just a thought process and how you might approach that. I think that most of the food processing that affects particularly food allergy is not really the additive that we talked about earlier, because what you're allergic to is the protein in the food. And the processing that goes on to break down a protein before the child or an adult is either sensitized or has a reaction, that's the most important thing. It doesn't really matter as much what else you put in the food, because it's really the protein and how the body sees it. That's what causes you to either develop or not develop the reaction. So say a peanut, if you heat a peanut, like you blanch it, that you might roast it, then that's different than if you chop a peanut up and boil it, and how my immune system sees it. So that's probably more important than the other things that we might add to it. But again, it's an interesting thought.
Well, and certainly we have reasons to be concerned and think about possible contaminants in the food system and in the food that we eat. But at least with this limited thing that we're talking about here this morning, the issue of food allergies, the thing is the chemical makeup of the food itself. Peanuts and something in the peanut that's probably always been there in the peanut. So it's not necessarily anything that we have done to it. That's just the way nature made it. And for some people, that's a problem.
Yes.
See if we can go at least one more. We'll go to line 3. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was diagnosed when I was a teenager with an allergy to household dust, insect dust, and yeast. And being a person who just loves, you know, bread and yeast-raised doughs, and I was still so surprised to find out that yeast was in ketchup and mustard and vinegar and sausage, and it was in so many things. So then as a teenager, I gave up, tried to totally give up everything, made a soda type of bread and just really was very strict about it. And then one time we were out, and I ate some, and the room was spinning, and I just had such a reaction that I thought maybe it's better to eat a little bit of it all the time. But my question is, does a person do themselves a disservice by giving it up, you know, at one time, and then maybe finding that they are allergic, but eating a little bit of it all the time just so that they don't have such a severe reaction? And then secondly, if you crave something, seriously, really, really crave it, could that indicate that you have an allergy to it?
Okay, both of them are good questions. The second one, the craving part, really hasn't been shown to correlate well with having allergic reactions to any of the foods. Probably more the correlation is for some people that have a food aversion, that they just don't like the taste, particularly of peanuts or some of the foods like that. That probably correlates more with having allergies than the craving of a food. The first question that you ask about whether you're to avoid it or take it in small amounts and to try to continually do that really very much depends on the food or the substance that you think you might be allergic to. If you're allergic to peanuts, then really the best treatment right now is to avoid it. If you try to take it in small amounts, then you run the risk of having a pretty serious life-threatening reaction. So it really is very dependent on the food that you're talking about.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry, we have a caller that we cannot take. We'll have to say thanks to our guest, Dr. Wesley Burks from Duke University Medical Center. And I do, though, want to mention one more time for people who are here in Champaign-Urbana, have questions about food allergies, particularly parents who are concerned about their kids. One sort of resource and support network for you can be this relatively new group that's now been organized here in our area. It's the Central Illinois Food Allergy Network. They have a website, so if you have internet access, it's www.cifan.org. And Dr. Burks, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.